Such questions as these are the practical realities of history, and in all that follows, we'll find them becoming clearer and more important, until, in our last chapter, we'll end, as all our days and years end, with a recapitulation of our hopes and fears, and a note of interrogation. Fourth, the development of free discussion in Europe during this age of fermentation was enormously stimulated by the appearance of printed books. It was the introduction of paper from the East that made practicable the long, latent method of printing. It's still difficult to assign the honor of priority in the use of the simple expedient of printing for multiplying books. It's a trivial question that has been preposterously debated. Apparently the glory, such as it is, belongs to Holland. In Haarlem, one Koster was printing from movable type somewhere before 1446. Gutenberg was printing at Mainz about the same time. There were printers in Italy by 1465, and Caxton set up his press in Westminster in 1477. But long before this time there had been a partial use of printing. Manuscripts as early as the 12th century display initial letters that may have been printed from wooden stamps. Far more important is the question of the manufacture of paper. It's scarcely too much to say that paper made the revival of Europe possible. Paper originated in China, where its use probably goes back to the 2nd century B.C. In 751, the Chinese made an attack upon the Arab Muslims in Samarkand. They were repulsed, and among the prisoners taken from them were some skilled papermakers, from whom the art was learnt. Arabic paper manuscripts from the 9th century onward still exist. The manufacture entered Christendom either through Greece or by the capture of Moorish paper mills during the Christian reconquest of Spain. But under the Christian Spanish, the product deteriorated sadly. Good paper wasn't made in Christian Europe until near the end of the 13th century, and then it was Italy which led the world. Only by the 14th century did the manufacture reach Germany, and not until the end of that century was it abundant and cheap enough for the printing of books to be a practicable business proposition. Thereupon printing followed naturally and necessarily, and the intellectual life of the world entered upon a new and far more vigorous phase. It ceased to be a little trickle from mind to mind. It became a broad flood in which thousands and presently scores and hundreds of thousands of minds participated. One immediate result of this achievement of printing was the appearance of an abundance of Bibles in the world. Another was a cheapening of school books. The knowledge of reading spread swiftly. There wasn't only a great increase of books in the world, but the books that were now made were plainer to read, and so easier to understand. Instead of toiling at a crabbed text and then thinking over its significance, readers could now think unimpeded as they read. With this increase in the facility of reading, the reading public grew. The book ceased to be a highly decorated toy or a scholar's mystery. People began to write books to be read as well as looked at by ordinary people. With the 14th century, the real history of the European literatures begins. We find a rapid replacement of local dialects by standard Italian, standard English, standard French, standard Spanish, and later standard German. These languages became literary languages in their several countries. They were tried over, polished by use, and made exact and vigorous. They became, at last, as capable of the burden of philosophical discussion as Greek or Latin. Fifth, here we devote a section to certain elementary statements about the movement in men's religious ideas during the 15th and 16th centuries. They are a necessary introduction to the political history of the 17th and 18th centuries that follows. We have to distinguish clearly between two entirely different systems of opposition to the Catholic Church. They intermingled very confusingly. The Church was losing its hold upon the consciences of princes and rich and able people. It was also losing the faith and confidence of common people. The effect of its decline of spiritual power upon the former class was to make them resent its interference, its moral restrictions, its claims to overlordship, its claim to tax, and to dissolve allegiances. They ceased to respect its power and its property. This insubordination of princes and rulers was going on throughout the Middle Ages, but it was only when in the 16th century the Church began to side openly with its old antagonist, the Emperor, when it offered him its support and accepted its help in its campaign against heresy, that princes began to think seriously of breaking away from the Roman Communion and setting up fragments of a church. And they would never have done so if they hadn't perceived that the hold of the Church upon the masses of mankind had relaxed. The revolt of the princes was essentially an irreligious revolt against the world rule of the Church. The Emperor Frederick II, with his epistles to his fellow princes, was its forerunner. The revolt of the people against the Church, on the other hand, was as essentially religious. They objected not to the Church's power, but to its weaknesses. They wanted a deeply righteous and fearless Church to help them and organize them against the wickedness of powerful men. Their movements against the Church, within it and without, were movements not for release from a religious control, but for a fuller and more abundant religious control. They didn't want less religious control, but more. But they wanted to be assured that it was religious. They objected to the Pope not because he was the religious head of the world, but because he was not, because he was a wealthy earthly prince, when he ought to have been their spiritual leader. The contest in Europe from the 14th century onward, therefore, was a three-cornered contest. The princes wanted to use the popular forces against the Pope, but not to let those forces grow too powerful for their own power and glory. For a long time, the Church went from prince to prince for an ally without realizing that the lost ally it needed to recover was popular veneration. Because of this triple aspect of the mental and moral conflicts that were going on in the 14th and 15th and 16th centuries, the series of ensuing changes, those changes that are known collectively in history as the Reformation, took on a threefold aspect. There was the Reformation according to the princes, who wanted to stop the flow of money to Rome and to seize the moral authority, the educational power, and the material possessions of the Church within their dominions. There was the Reformation according to the people, who sought to make Christianity a power against unrighteousness, and particularly against the unrighteousness of the rich and powerful. And finally, there was the Reformation within the Church, of which St. Francis of Assisi was the precursor, which sought to restore the goodness of the Church, and, through its goodness, to restore its power. The Reformation, according to the princes, took the form of a replacement of the Pope by the prince, as the head of the religion and the controller of the consciences of his people. The princes had no idea and no intention of letting free the judgments of their subjects, more particularly with the object lessons of the Hussites and the Anabaptists before their eyes. They sought to establish national churches dependent upon the throne. As England, Scotland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, North Germany, and Bohemia broke away from the Roman Communion, the princes and other ministers showed the utmost solicitude to keep the movement well under control. Just as much reformation as would sever the link with Rome they permitted. Anything beyond that, any dangerous break towards the primitive teachings of Jesus, or the crude, direct interpretation of the Bible, they resisted.